The following presentation was recorded live by HAudio.com.
Today what we're going to deal with, I sort of raced through the end of the destruction of the Second Temple. I want to just talk for a few minutes about that. I said we're going to do Christianity. I'm going to save it till tomorrow because I want to go through the Bar Kokhba uprising and what happens immediately in the aftermath of that, which is, again, a very significant event in Jewish history. Okay, so just remember, the end of the Second Temple, we're talking about the year 70, okay, when the Romans destroy the Temple. Huge disaster. We're still living in the diaspora caused by the destruction of the Second Temple. And as I said many times before, those same problems that plagued us and that caused the destruction of the Second Temple, meaning from the Jewish perspective, the internal hatred, as it says in Yuma, the Talmud in Yuma, why was the Second Temple destroyed? Because of causeless hatred of one Jew for another. Sinat chinam. Sinas chinam, as we say in Yeshivish. Okay, which obviously the flip side is what's the solution? Is avas chinam. That Jews have to learn to love Jews. Okay, have to learn to love each other and respect each other first. There's no hope for the Jewish people until we learn how to communicate with each other regardless of our differences and respect each other regardless of our differences. The most dangerous, and to me this is always the lesson of this period of time, the most dangerous situation for us to be in, Iran having nuclear weapons, God forbid, is nowhere near as scary to me as Jews fighting amongst each other. God forbid we get to a situation when Jews not just call each other names, but threaten each other with violence of one Jew for another. Bad news. God has no patience for us killing each other. He says, you want to kill each other? I'll get some Gentiles to do it for you. Okay, and that's what's going to happen. So we have to be extremely aware of that, which is why it is so dangerous to get involved in serious partisan politics and hating Jews. And I see Jews often feel worse about other Jews than they feel about, you know, Gentiles. And you see Jews say things about each other, it's scary. So you have to be very, very aware of that. It's the big lesson. I wanted to read you, by the way, we talked about Josephus. I want to read you the Roman account of the destruction. The Romans is no account written at the time. The Roman historian that we use for this period of time is Deo Cassius, who actually lives later. He lives middle of the 2nd century until the early 3rd century, about 164 to 229. Okay, all the Roman historians, by the way, are pretty much anti-Semitic. They make it very clear they don't like the Jews. We have at this period of time all kinds of low-level intellectual anti-Semitism against the Jews. You read people like Tacitus, Seneca, people like that, they often will say negative things. But this is Deo Cassius, doesn't say too much about the Jews negative, but he's just giving his very brief account of what's going on during the destruction. So I just want to read it to you so you can get a sense of how the Gentiles view what was happening at the time. He says, Titus, who had been assigned to the war against the Jews, undertook to win them over by certain representations and promises, but as they would not yield, he now proceeded to wage war upon them, blah, 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 blah. He talks about the siege. Of course, Romans are always going to be painted as being moderate and peace-loving and whatever. Here's the actual destruction here. Though a breach was made in the wall by means of engines, nevertheless, the capture of the place did not immediately follow even then. On the contrary, the defenders killed great numbers who tried to crowd through the opening, and they also set fire to some of the buildings nearby, hoping thus to check the further progress of the Romans. Nevertheless, the soldiers, because of their superstition, did not immediately rush in, but at last, under the compulsion from Titus, they made their way inside. Then the Jews defended themselves much more vigorously than before, as if they had discovered a piece of rare good fortune in being able to fight near the temple and fall on its defense. So talking about breaking through the Antonia fortress and keeping the Romans out. The Jews are really going crazy now. The populace was stationed below in the court, and the senators on the steps. I don't know which senators we're talking about here, and the priests in the sanctuary itself. And though they were but a handful fighting against a far superior force, they were not conquered until part of the temple was set on fire. Then they met their death willingly, some throwing themselves on the sword of the Romans, some slaying one another, others taking their own lives, and still others leaping into the flames. And it seemed to everybody, and especially to them, that so far from being destruction, it was victory and salvation and happiness to them that they perished along with the temple. Yet even under these conditions, many captives were taken, amongst them Bar Giora. This is Shimon Bar Giora, the guy who is one of the leaders of the revolt, their leader. And he was the only one to be executed in connection with the triumphal celebration. Bar Giora and One of them was in prison, one was executed. Thus was Jerusalem destroyed on the very day of Saturn, which is Saturday, the day which even now the Jews reverence most. It means the Sabbath. For the time from this time forth was ordered that the Jews who continued to observe their ancestral customs should pay an annual tribute of 2 denarii to Jupiter Capitolinus. In consequence of this success, both generals received the title of imperator, but neither got that of Judaicus, although all other honors that were fitting on the occasion of such a magnificent victory, including triumphal arches, were voted to them. So, Bar Giora is executed. He's brought back to Rome, along with a huge number of captives. The Romans, Titus, built an arch called Titus's Arch, which is next to the... Have you been to the Forum in Rome? Anyone been to the Forum? You can see it in... anyone been to the Forum in Rome? In the modern city of Rome, there's a Forum. There's a white arch. On the inside is a famous portrayal of the Romans carrying away the loot from the temple. It was, by the way, Jewish tradition in the Roman Jewish community that Jews would never walk under that arch. And on May 14th, I think it was the night of May 14th, 1948... the Jewish community of Rome, that's the day Israel was declared a state, had a triumphant parade and marched under the arch. Rome is gone, we're still around. It's a great, what a great victory there. But at the time, it was a tremendous, tremendous disaster. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people dying, communities destroyed, hundreds of communities destroyed. There's so many Jews flooded the slave markets, they said, after the Great Revolt, which was a huge revolt, that you could get a Jewish slave for less than the price of a horse. That's the comment made by the Romans. Okay, they were brought back. This idea of triumph, you know the word triumph? He comes in triumph. Comes from the parade that the Romans would hold in the Forum. They would bring back all the treasure and the noble captives like Shimon Bar Giora, and they would march them through. He was beheaded afterwards. I'm trying to think, which is the other? It wasn't Yochanan Gush Halav. One of them was kept in the prison. If you go to the prison in the Forum, you could see where his name is on a plaque still there. He was like one of the more important prisoners kept in that prison. But they were marched through, and Titus, of course, would sit on a big throne, and you know, all the Senate would watch. It was honoring a mighty general. They built an arch in his honor. They minted coins in his honor. By the way, it's interesting. When the general would sit on the throne, they would hold like a crown of branches, olive branches above his head, like a victory crown, and someone would sit next to him and whisper in his ear, "Remember, you're only mortal, so you shouldn't get too big a head." But the Romans consider this a big victory. What's interesting is Deo Cassius says that from then on, the Jews are given a punitive tax. It's called Fiscus Judaicus. The Jews were forced, the Romans minted special coins with like a woman sitting there weeping, and it says Judea Capta, Jerusalem is destroyed, captured. It's a big thing. The Jews had to pay a punitive tax as punishment. Okay, and it went, of course, the ultimate affront was that it went to the temple of Jupiter, which is the Roman god Zeus. Okay, so the worst thing was it wasn't bad enough Jews had to pay a tax; it had to go to maintaining the idolatrous temple in Rome. Okay, so that was interesting. Another way of humiliating the Jews. Yes, sir.
Do you know which part of the law they broke?
The Romans broke through every time Jerusalem is besieged and broken through, pretty much without exception, is the northern part, by Damascus Gate. Why? Because it's the one part of the city that has no natural valleys. Jerusalem is built on three valleys. You have the Tyropian, you have the Kidron Valley. Right, so it's their natural defenses that you don't attack from either the east or the west. So it's always from the north, whether it's the Crusaders or you name it, they break through there. So they work their way. If you read again Josephus, I refer you to him as always. He gives a detailed description of what's going on at this time.
No, the
walls of Jaffa Gate today are Turkish walls from the early 16th century. None of the Roman walls survived except maybe some foundation parts of them. The only piece that survives is from Herod's wall in the Temple Mount area. The rest is all destroyed. The stones are reused in other buildings, but they're all destroyed. Yes, sir?
What is the punitive tax going to?
It went to Jupiter, as Deo Cassius says. He says that they were 2 denarii to Jupiter Capitolinus. Jupiter, the god of the capital of Rome. Cities had, even the Greeks, Romans, certain cities. Athens, who do you think the god of Athens was? Athena, right? You had a big temple built to honor that specific god. The money went to that. Okay. Now remember and you can see, by the way, evidence of the destruction. If you go to the underneath the Yeshivat HaKotel, you can see these big Herodian mansions, probably houses of the Kohanim, probably destroyed in September of the year 70 when Jerusalem fell. The whole city took weeks to conquer the whole city, house to house fighting till the very end. You go to the burnt house underneath the old milk dining room of Eshet Torah, you can also see where you can see clear evidence of destruction, where the roof beams fell in the Herodian mansions. You can see still a beam there. A charred beam on the floor. And the Herodian man, in the burnt house, you can see they found a woman's arm, skeletal arm, a spear You know, you can see the level of destruction. Again, if you read Josephus, it was brutal. The Romans punished tremendously. They destroyed the whole city, destroyed the walls, destroyed the temple, only leaving the lower retaining walls, which the Western Wall is one part of. All the Western Wall is, I always hear people mentioning erroneously, it's part of Solomon's temple. A, it's not part of any temple. It's part of the retaining wall that supported the platform on which the temple stood. And it's nothing to do with Solomon. It has to do with Herod. And B, it's not the holiest site in the Jewish world. Okay, the holiest site in the Jewish world is the site of the Holy of Holies where the temple stood on top of. Okay, for us today, because of the prohibition, we don't go up, as I explained previously, we don't go up to the site. But I hate when tour guides say, the holiest site in the Jewish world is the Western Wall. It's like owning a Mercedes, having it explode, and being left with the hood ornament and saying it's the most important part of the car, you know? It's nothing. It's like, so we have to keep that in mind. Now remember the story we talked about of Yochanan ben Zakkai going to see Vespasian. Remember the last class we mentioned, he says, "Hail to you, mighty Caesar." And the major request that he makes of Vespasian is that he should give me 10 li Yavna v'chachameya. Give me the city of Yavna and its sages. Again, realizing that Jerusalem was doomed, but as long as Torah survives, the Jewish people will survive. After the destruction of the temple, there's no longer any Jewish, you know, temporal authorities, no kings. Rome reverts to direct rule, very strict rule. Roman legion stationed here. The 10th Roman Legion, Fratensis, was stationed here. We found they had, by the Hilton Hotel, we find all kinds of remnants. That was the camp where the Hilton Hotel is today. Not, it's not the Hilton anymore. It's the one by the entrance to Jerusalem. What's it called now? It used to be the Hilton. That really tall hotel. Sorry? It's a Sheraton now or whatever it is. That was being, sorry? The Holiday Inn, you're right. The Holiday Inn, that was the major camp of the 10th Roman Legion when they were in Jerusalem. Legions were kept here from then on because Israel was considered a hot spot. Not because of the external threat, because the Jews were considered not safe people. They couldn't be left to their own anymore. Okay, you have to be watched very carefully. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, from this period of time, the Romans are going to allow the Jews and the rabbis specifically to be the go-betweens between the local population and themselves. So the position, the authority of the rabbis. Before we had, you know, puppet kings and this, and Agrippa's the first and Agrippa's the second. There's no more high priesthood. All these extreme groups, the Essenes, the Sadducees, ceased to exist with the destruction of the Second Temple. Since they were all focused on the corrupted high priesthood, there's no more temple, no more priesthood, they're gone. The Essenes, what happened to the Dead Sea sect? They're probably slaughtered by the Romans. They disappear. The Messiah didn't come. All the messianic expectation is gone. Bam. Who is more or less left? A lot of Gentiles and the Pharisees. That's the major group that survives. The rabbis are going to assume the mantle of absolute authority in the Jewish world. From that period of time onward, their position is going to rise to a tremendous position of power now. Not that they have a lot of political authority in the land. The Romans basically have complete control. But as the only unifying authority in the land of Israel, it's going to be their job to keep the Jewish people together and ensure the transmission process. So Yochanan ben Zakkai is going to move the center of Jewish learning to a place called Yavna, which is on the way to the coastal plain to Tel Aviv. It says, by the way, in the Talmud Bavli, in Rosh Hashanah, I think it's 31 Aleph, it gives the whole order of where the Sanhedrin is going to move, and it's going to move a lot from the end of the first century until the middle of the third century, when it's finally disbanded by the Christian Roman authorities. It's going to go from Jerusalem to Yavna, to Usha, to Shfaram. These are all places up in the north, most of them in the Galilee. To Beit Sha'arim, to Tzipori. Anyone been to Tzipori? Very interesting and significant place in the Jewish world. And eventually, the last place it's going to sit is in Tiberias. Okay, which is why Tiberias has the title of one of the holy cities of the land of Israel. The holy cities of the land of Israel: Hebron, Jerusalem, Sfat, Tiberias. Why Tiberias? Because the Mishnah is going to be put together because the last place the Sanhedrin sat, and the Mishnah is going to be put together there and in Tzipori. Okay, so it's a very, very significant place in terms of Jewish history, even though Tiberias is named after the Roman Emperor Tiberius. Yeah?
Where did the temple go after Asha?
Temple didn't go anywhere. The Sanhedrin.
I mean the Sanhedrin.
It went from Usha to Shfaram, to Beit Sha'arim, to Tzipori, to Tiberias.
Okay.
That's the generally accepted order. Okay. Okay, but that's going to be the central institution, which means Jerusalem is not going to be, it's going to be more or less a pagan city. It's going to be, the majority of the population is going to be pagan. Jews are still allowed into Jerusalem, but it's not a Jewish city, so to speak, anymore. It's an unwalled city with a Roman legion stationed in the area. Okay, now, just to jump a little bit ahead in Jewish history, I mentioned previously that we're talking about Rome, that the Jewish people have the notoriety of rebelling more against the Romans than anyone else. The period of 20 BCE to 180 is called Pax Romana, Roman peace, which is not a period. If you know Jewish history, it's ironic that most of the great revolts are going to take place, that all the Jewish revolts are going to take place within that period of time. Okay? So it was not a period of complete peace, but it was a period when the Roman Empire is going to expand tremendously. Anyone know which emperor the Roman Empire reaches the height of its power in terms of physical conquest of the world? It's actually not Augustus, it's Hadrian. The Roman Empire is going to double in size every, you know, millennia. It's much, much bigger, after Augustus in Hadrian's time, in around 117. So, Trajan is the peak of Roman power. Trajan is going to embark on a campaign around the year 114, 115. A campaign to crush the Parthians. The Parthians were the Persian Empire, which was on the border, the eastern border of the Roman Empire, the one major empire that Rome did not conquer. Initially is successful, then the Persians counterattack. Okay? And he suffers a series of very disastrous losses. What happens then? The Jews see an opportunity to revolt again. Which is amazing that after, we're talking about 40 years after the destruction of the Second Temple. Oh, but I skipped an event here. Excuse me. I have to stop here a minute. Let's go back for 1 second. I didn't mention Masada. I want to mention that for a minute. I'm sorry. The temple falls in 9th of Av of the year 70, again. A couple of different outposts will hold out a little longer. There's a few Herodian fortresses that are occupied by zealot forces that are going to hold out up to 3 years later. The three big ones we know of are Herodium, which is this artificial mountain fortress a few miles to the south of Jerusalem, which falls. Michvar, which is today in Jordan, on the other side of the Jordan River. And last, but certainly not least, and most famous in modern Zionist ideology, is Masada, okay, which is this beautiful artificial, which is a beautiful fortress built on the top of this mesa right above the Dead Sea. Incredible piece of fortification, virtually impregnable, with all the creature comforts that Herod could put into it. Masada holds out till 73. Okay, and in 73, the Flavius Silva, who is the Roman general, was responsible for the siege. If you can go there today and see, Josephus describes it again beautifully. They built the siege ramp up. They piled earth using Jewish slave labor. You can still see the ramp. It's still there. 2,000 years later, it's amazing. You can see the ramp going up. The Romans roll a big tower up. When the defenders attempt to destroy the tower, it doesn't work. They realize the Romans are going to successfully breach the walls. And the 900 and such defenders, according to Josephus, decide rather than being slaughtered by the Romans, they'll commit mass suicide. And Josephus records the speech by Eliezer ben Yair, who is the leader of the defenders. Again, Josephus wasn't there. This is a common literary tool used by ancient historians and writers, making up speeches. He claims it was, but the story he heard from a couple of women who survived, you can be sure it is not accurate, but it reflects accurately the ideology of the people living at the time, which is this idea of martyrdom, of better to live, to die free at our own hands, and be slaves to the Romans and suffer all the horrible humiliations and be fed to lions and who knows. Masada in modern Zionist machismo has become the major story. We don't even know what it occurred about. We do not know if they committed suicide. There's no evidence ever found. We know of other places like Gamla, which is called the Masada of the North, which is a major fortress city in the Golan Heights, which is an amazing place to visit, nowhere near as accessible. And places like the Arabelle that I mentioned, there are plenty of places we know where Jews did commit suicide rather than surrender to the Romans. Even Deo Cassius describes it in his history. But it definitely gives you, whether it did happen, didn't happen the way it happened, we never know. Okay, it's one of the great mysteries of Josephus. But one thing's for sure, it gives us a very strong sense of the Jewish ideology of the period of time. And we appreciate why the modern state of Israel is so into the Masada ideology. These were people who fought to the death, who didn't roll over and die. And this is the modern Jewish macho ideal that was such a big thing in the early years of the state. Up until recently, army soldiers would go up there and be sworn in. And the motto was, Masada will never fall again. Like, remember the Alamo. You know, when we get to modern Zionist history, I understand why it's such a big thing. Yeah, Max.
So you're saying that other than Josephus, there is no substantial evidence?
No, the site has been very well excavated. No human remains were found. It doesn't prove anything. In archaeology, the big rule is lack of evidence is no evidence of lack. We don't know. We don't know. We don't know. We know that it was besieged, yes. No one denies it was a siege. We can see the remembrance of the siege. The whole, just the end story where they chose to commit suicide and the speech and all that stuff, we don't know. Yigal Yadin found a pottery shard. The last group of defenders, they drew lots to decide who was going to kill whom of their families and who was going to kill the last guy, and the last guy would kill himself. Yigal Yadin, the great Israeli archaeologist, found on Masada a piece of pottery, which is a common implement you wrote on instead of paper. It was written on Ben Yair. And he said this could be the shard, the lottery shard used by Ben Yair, that he pulled out of like his whatever hat, and he was the last guy to die and whatever. Maybe yes, maybe no, we don't know. Okay, but it's very important that where Masada fits in. It's the last stronghold that falls. With that, the revolt officially ends. Okay, let's jump ahead to 114, 115, 116. Trajan attacks Persia, initially successful, then starts to lose, loses a couple of very significant defeats. The Jews decide we're going to rise up and revolt again. Why are they rising up in revolt? This is a very little-known chapter in Jewish history. It's called Quietus' War in Jewish sources, or Quietus, after the Roman general Quietus, who's one of the major people who's involved in crushing the revolt. Okay? The Jews do not rise up. As far as we know, in Israel, there's no revolt. The Jewish people are not in a position in Israel to revolt, having just suffered a few decades before a humiliating destruction at the hands of the Romans. But all of the Jewish communities in diaspora, remember we're talking about 15 to 20% of the Jewish population, of the population of certain cities. In places like Alexandria, probably a third of the population is Jewish, is rising up in revolt. Why? Because after the destruction of the Second Temple, the level of hostility towards the Jews is going to increase tremendously. The average Roman in the Roman world is going to look at the Jew as a person who is hostile to Rome and Roman law. Jews are going to get the official title of deditici, I think is what it's called in Latin, which is an enemy status. The official status is going to be people who are hostile to Roman law. After all this is done, they're going to be considered to be officially labeled as enemies of the state. We will allow you to live in the Roman Empire, but you're going to have a lot of problems. You're going to be punitively taxed. You're going to be looked at very suspiciously. I mean, we earned the reputation, for sure, having rebelled more than anyone else. So the Jewish communities, hold on, of Alexandria, which again is something like a third Jewish, the most cultured city in the world, rises up. In Cyprus, all throughout Syria, Antioch, everywhere, all the major Jewish communities we know of, not so much in Europe, but in the Eastern Roman Empire, rise up. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of Jews rising up in revolt, initially, by the way, very successful in certain places. Then the Romans are going to get their act together, and with the help of the Gentile inhabitants, who are just looking for an opportunity to slaughter the Jews now, are going to crush the revolts. Okay, hundreds of thousands of Jews could have died in these. We don't know the numbers. Certainly in places like Cyprus, thousands and thousands of Jews are slaughtered, and all Jews are expelled from the island. It's interesting. Today, there are no Jews in Cyprus. But 2,000 years ago, they were a very significant proportion of the population of Cyprus was Jewish. I think it's like one or two synagogues there even from... But this is Quietus' War, Quietus' War. A little-known example of people who would be granted citizens of the Roman Empire, made citizens, and considered to be loyal to Rome. Okay, so the Jews had a very uniquely hostile status in the Roman world. The Romans, in the heat of battle, would be absolutely vicious and brutal. The Romans do not embark on policies of just extermination of entire peoples. That's something you only see, basically, things like the Nazis doing in the 20th century. But if you messed with them, again, it wasn't the Roman interest to try and slaughter people. It doesn't look good in the empire. If the rest of the empire got wind of the fact that the Romans would embark on genocide, you know, other people might get an idea that maybe we should all rebel. They're always very practical people. Okay, the last event I want to focus on is the Bar Kokhba uprising. Because this is the last attempt and the most successful attempt of the Jews to throw the Romans out of the land of Israel. The Bar Kokhba uprising has similarities but many, many differences. The differences being, of course, that the Jews don't have Jerusalem in the Bar Kokhba uprising. But there's a lot of positive differences in that the Jews are unified in Bar Kokhba uprising, whereas they're disunified in the Great Revolt of 67 to 70. In 117, after Trajan is gone, Hadrian takes over. Now, Hadrian, actually, you should never judge leaders of the world by how they treat the Jews, because some of the most competent leaders of the West have been some of the biggest anti-Semites. You know, people. Seriously, people like Edward I is actually a very good king of England, even though he's the competent, not good, not a nice moral man, but a competent king of England, even though he expels the Jews in 1290. Despite what Braveheart movie says about him, he was not like this evil guy, you know. Hadrian is actually one of the more enlightened Roman emperors and a very competent emperor. And initially, it seems that during his revolt, during his reign, the early part of his reign, he seems to be quite tolerant of the Jews. But we also know that Hadrian was someone, by this period of time in the Roman Empire, many Romans viewed themselves as literally being reincarnations of the Greeks. And that's like almost spiritually, metaphysically, Kabbalistically, we are the Greeks. You know, we're a different people, Rome, than Greece, but we're them. We inherited not just their culture, but we are them. Hadrian is someone who is very clearly into this ideology. If you look at Hadrian's palace, you see in Rome, it's very into the Greek ideal. And whereas he starts out tolerant of the Jews, he seems to almost be a reincarnation of Antiochus Epiphanes the IV, you know, the guy who leads the great attempt to, you know, exterminate Judaism going back to the 2nd century before the Common Era. He embarks on a very similar policy of crushing Judaism. Okay, now, and this is going to trigger the last and really greatest revolt, really in terms of actual fighting going on, the greatest revolt against the Romans within the empire at the time, and certainly the greatest revolt amongst the Jews. What triggered the revolt? Okay, it's a matter of speculation amongst historians. It seems that Hadrian issued a number of decrees against the Jews, banning teaching of Torah and all the things that the same thing like the Greeks did. When exactly he did this, we're not sure. It's not clear from the sources. He did this before, he did this after. One of the major events which people speculate on is he was attempting to build a temple to Jupiter on the Temple Mount. Now, it's one thing to have the temple destroyed. When the temple stood, the Romans were very careful not to incite the Jews by putting any images up there, because images in Judaism were completely anathema, were unacceptable. But it seems like by this period of time, Hadrian decides he'll show the Jews who's boss, we'll build a temple to Jupiter. And that is the ultimate outrage. Since idolatry is the ultimate no-no, nothing could be worse than taking the holiest spot in the Jewish world and putting a temple to the biggest Roman god on it. Okay? Which triggers this revolt, which is going to be known as the Bar Kokhba revolt. Which, by the way, for many, 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 many centuries was sort of only in a limited number of sources until we found in Nachal Hever, near the Dead Sea, the Bar Kokhba letters. If you go to the Israel Museum, you can see the Bar Kokhba letters. They are absolutely fascinating. His name is mentioned. We have letters in his hand written by him. We have letters written to him and from him. Many of them are military dispatches. Very interesting, by the way, the dispatches. Some of them are like, it's Sukkot is coming. We need like Esrogim and Lulavim. We need our four species. This is a religious Jewish army, you know. These are not people who are, you know. Very interesting to read. But it gives a tremendous amount of historicity to the character of Bar Kokhba. It really comes to light with those finds. Because you had lots of Jews hanging out in caves hiding from the Romans. And they found these letters afterwards. The revolt, the official dates for the revolt are like 132 to 135 of the Common Era. The revolt actually starts before that. Okay, meaning there's uprisings and flare-ups throughout the land of Israel because of the, again, rise in the tension between the Romans and the pagans and the Jews. But the official revolt is going to break out, according to most historical sources, they give the year 132. Unlike the first revolt, where you have all these sectarian groups, you know, vying for power and fighting amongst each other, the Jewish armies seem to rally around this guy Bar Kokhba. Now, where he's from, we're not sure. There's a place called, his actual name is Bar Koziva. There is a place called Koziva, not far from Jerusalem. They speculate that is where he's from. He's given the name Bar Kokhba. The tradition has it that Rabbi Akiva, recognizing him as the guy who could be the Messiah, he gets this nickname, Bar Kokhba. The rabbis of the Talmud say that his real name is Bar Koziva, meaning son of a lie. He was a false Messiah. But if Rabbi Akiva, who is one of the most significant scholars in Jewish history, a major, major person involved in the whole transmission of the oral law, you name it, no one's fool, recognized this guy as having messianic potential, you can be sure he was a very impressive man. And the whole idea, Bar Kokhba means son of star. It's an allusion to, there's a quote in Bar Midbar, 24:17, which talks about a star will go out of Jacob, which is the idea of the Messiah. You know, messianic potential. So that's where he gets his nickname from, Bar Kokhba. And we see the whole Jewish people rallies around him. It describes him, the Jewish accounts describing him as a man of tremendous physical strength, that he can uproot a tree, riding on a horse, you know, you run by, you know, whip the thing out. Okay, probably an exaggeration, but he's obviously a big guy, very strong. And he's obviously a guy who was not an Am Haaretz. He wasn't an ignoramus. For Rabbi Akiva to think that he had the messianic potential, he must have been a Torah scholar. And what's the most impressive part of him is he seems to have united virtually the entire Jewish people. That's the biggest accomplishment. That you can answer some halachic questions is pretty impressive. But that you can get the majority of the Jewish people to listen to you is a much more impressive feat. Okay? He organizes an army around him. Now, again, the Jewish sources put the army at huge, like 100,000 men. Could he have had that many? Possibly. I personally think it's an exaggeration. But even if you had 50, 60,000 men, that's a huge number of people. Now, clearly, they're no match for the Romans. Okay? But they revolt successfully. They throw the Romans out of the land of Israel. They declare independence, mint coins. That's pretty much a unique event at that period of time in the Roman Empire. No one was throwing the Romans out of anywhere yet. But then, okay, within after 180, Rome begins its decline. By year 200, Rome is definitely in decline. Okay, third century is a bad time for the Roman Empire. But this period of time, Rome was at the height of its power. No one was throwing the Romans out of anywhere. For the Romans to be thrown out was bad news. The Romans would not allow, there's no way a guy like Hadrian could allow this precedent to be set. He takes his best general, Julius Severus. He brings him from England. Okay, and they start pouring Roman legions into the land of Israel to crush Bar Kokhba. The Romans were afraid to meet the Jews in open battle, which is pretty impressive because the Romans were the master of open battle because the Jews were so crazy. And like, remember Japanese in the Pacific? Fought so well, and there were so many of them, and they didn't care. They didn't care about dying. And the Romans were afraid to fight them in open battle. I want to read you Deo Cassius, again, our Roman historian friend who lives after this revolt also, but I want to read you Deo Cassius' description of the Bar Kokhba uprising. At Jerusalem, Hadrian founded a city in the place of one that which had been razed to the ground, naming it Aelia Capitolina. Hadrian founds a new pagan city, Aelia Capitolina. Aelia was Hadrian, one of Hadrian's names, capital, the capital. Okay, pagan Roman city. And on the site of the temple of the god, he raised a new temple to Jupiter. This brought on a war of no slight importance nor of brief duration, for the Jews deemed it intolerable that a foreign race should be settled in their city and foreign religious rites planted there. So long, indeed, as Hadrian was close by the Egypt and again in Syria, they remained quiet, save insofar as they purposely made of poor quality such weapons as they were called upon to furnish in order that the Romans might reject them and they themselves might thus have the use of them. Meaning the Jews who made Roman weapons deliberately made them defective, so the Romans would reject them, the Jews would keep them. That's how they secretly armed themselves. But when he went further away, they openly revolted. To be sure, they did not dare try conclusions with the Romans in open field. But they occupied the advantageous positions in the country and strengthened them with mines and walls. I don't know what mines we're talking about, but in order that they might have a place of refuge wherever they should be and hard-pressed and might meet together unobserved underground. They built all these cool caverns and caves. We found them all over the country, hiding places. Guerrilla warfare we're talking about. And they pierced these subterranean passages from above at intervals to let in air and light. At first the Romans took no account of them. Soon, however, all Judea had been stirred up, and the Jews everywhere were showing signs of disturbances, were gathering together and giving evidence of great hostility to the Romans, partly by secret and partly by overt acts. Many outside nations, too, were joining them through eagerness for gain, and the whole earth, one might almost say, was being stirred up in every matter. See what he's saying? This is a serious thing. This could spread to the entire Roman Empire. Then, indeed, Hadrian sent against them his best general. First of this was Julius Severus, who was dispatched from Britain, where he was governor against the Jews. Severus did not venture to attack his opponents in the open at any one point in view of their numbers and their desperation. But by intercepting small groups, thanks to the numbers of soldiers and his under officers, and by depriving them of food and shutting them up, he was able, rather slowly to be sure, but with comparatively little danger, to crush, exhaust, and exterminate them. Very few of them, in fact, survived. 50 of their most important outposts and 985 of their most famous villages were razed to the ground. He's saying he had 1,000 villages. Again, probably an exaggeration, but you could be sure a lot destroyed. 580,000 men were slain in various raids and battles, and the number of those who perished by famine, disease, and fire was past finding out. Which, by the way, is also an exaggeration, because there probably weren't even 1 million Jews in Israel at the time. But it was very, very bad news. Thus nearly the whole of Judea was made desolate, a result of which the people had forewarning before the war. For the tomb of Solomon, which the Jews regarded as an object of veneration, fell to pieces of itself and collapsed, and many wolves and hyenas rushed howling into the cities. Many Romans, however, perished in this war. Therefore, Hadrian, in writing to the Senate, did not employ the opening phrase commonly affected by his emperors. If you and your children are in health, it is well, and I and my legions are in health. Very interesting what he's saying. He's saying, first of all, the revolt was very bloody and very costly. The Jews suffered tremendously. The Romans lost an entire legion in battle. That's not left out here. The 22nd Roman legion walked into an ambush and was slaughtered. By the end of the revolt, the Romans had 12 legions in the land of Israel. That's an incredible number of soldiers. That is virtually half the army of the entire Roman Empire had to be brought into the land of Israel to crush the Jews. You have no idea what a big revolt it was. Huge. Yeah.
Is this what led eventually to the northern borders of the Roman Empire being poorly defended?
No, it wasn't. There was no other big. The Rome rotted for not at this time. At this time, there wasn't the big barbarian rush didn't come at this period of time. But we see it was a very significant fight. The Romans would not fight the Jews in the open, which shows you how serious a threat they were. But he describes how they were able to whittle the Jews down. Eventually, it says that Bar Kokhba makes his final stand in the city of Beitar, which is the southwest of Jerusalem. You can go there today. It's a religious community right by there. It's an Arab village called Batir. It is not an excavated site. It's a site that's been pillaged and built over the centuries. But you go to the village of Batir, it's near the Jewish community of Beitar. The city holds out. After protracted siege, the city falls. The Romans slaughter everyone in the city. They are really out for blood. You can see the Romans have had enough from the Jews already. You rebel 3 times in 70 years? Okay, tremendous slaughter. I want to just read you the last thing here. This is from Gittin, Talmud Gittin, 57 Aleph. It's the Jewish perspective on what happens. It says, because of the shaft of a litter, Beitar was destroyed. For they had a custom that when a baby was born, they planted a cedar tree, and for a baby girl, they planted a pine tree. And when they would marry, they would cut them down and make a marriage canopy of the branches. One day the daughter of Caesar was passing, and the shaft of her litter broke. They cut down a cedar and brought it to her. The Jews of Beitar fell upon them and beat them. They reported it to Caesar, and the Jews were rebelling, and he marched against them. It's interesting, the whole account of what caused the revolt. He cut off and this is going through a bunch of descriptions of sentences. He cut off the fierce anger, all the horn of Israel. This is from Lamentations, said Rabbi Zira. And Rabbi Abahu said, Rabbi Yochanan, these are the 80 battle horns which they brought into the city of Beitar at the time it was captured. And they killed their men and women and children until their blood flowed into the Mediterranean Sea. Lest you think it was near, it was a Roman mile away. It has been taught, Rabbi Eliezer the elder said, there are two streams in the valley of Yadayim, one running in one direction and one running in the other direction. And the sages estimate that they ran 2 parts water to 1 part blood. It was taught in a brisa. For 7 years, the Gentiles cultivated their vineyards with the blood of Israel without requiring manure for fertilization. So this is like they're saying, this was a big slaughter. Why did we lose? And this is a very important lesson in Jewish history. We say we lost primarily because, you know, in the 67 war, Israel won an amazing victory. And what was the average Israeli's attitude? By my strength and my valor, I did this. The rabbinic perspective on the fall of Bar Kokhba was that he got arrogant. He was winning initially. He could have been the Messiah. If Rabbi Akiva said he could have been. He obviously had the potential. Lots of people in history have had the potential, but he blows it. And because he blows it, he starts to lose. We have to always realize in Jewish history, our perspective is who's winning the battles for us? We make the effort, but God wins the battles. We have to realize it's not our strength and our might that's doing it. As a matter of fact, at the end of the story of the Siege of Beitar, it says that Shimon Bar Kosiva, Bar Kokhba, his uncle is Rabbi Eliezer HaModai. He accuses his uncle of being a traitor for the Romans. And he kicks him in the head and kills him. And he says, when that happened, that was it. That's it. As soon as you start killing Jews, and you kill a big rabbi, you accuse him of being a traitor, you're finished. The city falls. What day does the city of Beitar fall on? The 9th of the year 135. The same day as the second temple. The same day as the first temple. Boy, do we have a lot to cry about on the 9th of Av. The Romans don't even let the bodies be buried. Okay, since a miracle took place and the bodies didn't rot, months and months and months later, the bodies are allowed to be buried, which is why we add in the blessing of Atovu Metiv in the blessing after the meal in Birkat HaMazon as a way of thanking God for the miracle of the bodies not rotting. Very interesting story. After that, the Romans keep the decrees into place. That Hadrian decides he's going to get rid of the Jewish people once and for all by getting rid of Judaism, what was left of the Jewish community of Israel. We'll talk about tremendous decimation. The Romans embark on another policy, by the way. They embark on a policy of cutting the Jews not only off from Judaism by their decrees. And this is where the stories of, we're talking about the 10 martyrs. You guys hear the 10 martyr stories, which you read on Yom Kippur, talking about, now the story is a lot of dramatic licenses taken in the story. There's different rabbis mentioned in different versions of the story. The story reads, if you look at a Yom Kippur prayer book, it mentions this very dramatic story. This is where Rabbi Akiva is flayed alive, right? They peel his skin off of him until they get to his head, and he's laughing, and his students say, Rebbe, how can you be laughing? Because all my life I wanted to be able to fulfill the passage, you shall love God with all your heart, with all your might, with all your soul. You know, and now I'm be able to do Kiddush Hashem and give my life for God, and I'm finally able to, you know, fulfill that passage in the Torah. And it says that when they got to the place of his tefillin, they're peeling his skin off, that he died. And they had like Rebbe Hananya ben Trajan, I think he was wrapped in a Torah scroll, and he's burned alive. And as they keep, they wet them down to make them burn slowly. Great story. A Roman soldier says, if I peel off the wrapping, well, can I go into heaven with you? And he says, yes. It's a fantastic story. And the Roman soldier peels off the wrapping and jumps into the fire with him. And they both get burned to death. And a voice from heaven says, the Rebbe Hananya ben Trajan and the Roman soldier both have a place in the world to come. Very interesting stories about martyrdom. But very brutal. The Romans just crushed the Jews. Another policy they embark on, which is very significant, is not only destroying Judaism spiritually or attempting to destroy Judaism spiritually, but attempting to cut the Jewish people off from the land of Israel. They take the whole country, Judea, which used to be called after Judah, the largest tribe, and they name it Philistia, after an extinct people called the Philistines, who disappeared hundreds of years before. Until modern days, the British reused the name Palestine. Very important point for modern political historical arguments about the land of Israel. The modern so-called Palestinians, there is no such thing as a descendant of a Philistine around today. Don't exist. They've resurrected a dead people and tried to reconnect to a heritage that's extinct as a way of claiming these modern Arabs that they are descendants of the original inhabitants who fought with King David in the land of Israel. Nonsense in history. Okay, just a big lie. Not saying there haven't been Arabs living here for centuries, that's a different point, but there are no such thing. And the word Philistine, just as today, like our Palestinian brethren want to rob us of our Jewish connections to the land of Israel, this was the Roman idea. Cut the Jews off from Israel. Name it non-Jewish. Take Jerusalem. Rename it Aelia Capitolina. Make non-Jewish. You know, the Jews were not allowed in Jerusalem, the first Judenrein city we know of in human history. The first place Jews are not allowed in human history, is Jerusalem. Jews are only allowed in Jerusalem one day a year. What's the one day a year we're allowed in on? The 9th of Av. So the Romans could rub their face in the fact that the temple was destroyed. They take all the cities of Israel are renamed non-Jewish names. They take the city of Shechem up north, where Joseph is buried. They rename it Neapolis, which in Latin is new city, right? Naples. Arabs can't pronounce P, so today they call it Nablus. Okay, it's a deliberate attempt to destroy the Jewish people. If not for the fact that the next Roman emperors were nicer guys and rescinded the decrees and gave the Jewish people some breathing space, who knows what would have been in Jewish history? We don't know. But it was a very, very, very difficult period of time. And by the way, it doesn't mean, these are called the Hadrianic persecutions, by the way. It doesn't mean there were no Jews in the land of Israel. There's still a significant Jewish population. But from certainly this period of time, even after the destruction of the Second Temple, the majority of the Jewish community is going to be up north in the Galilee. Okay, the whole southern part of the country is going to be denuded of Jews, more or less. And again, Jerusalem is going to become this pagan Roman city. And that's pretty much the way it's going to remain. It's going to become pagan, then it's going to come into Christian, then it's going to become Muslim. It's not going to return to be a Jewish city until pretty much this century. Okay, I want to stop there. I didn't get to exactly where I wanted to, but tomorrow we're going to do Yehuda Hanasi, the Mishnah, the Talmud, very important stuff. Where the Sanhedrin is afterwards, and then we'll get into the Christianity thing.
You have been listening to aishaudio.com. For information about our online services, visit our website. To contact one of our representatives, write to aishaudio@aish.com. Shalom from Jerusalem.